This is Focus West Michigan from WGVU for Tuesday, March 10, 2026. I'm Rick Bierling in for Joe Bilecki. In local news, Grand Rapids officials are preparing for the opening of the Acrisure Amphitheater in May, specifically addressing downtown vehicle and foot traffic flows before and after concerts. WGVU's David Limbaugh has more.
It's going to take 24 cops to do it, at least initially, which is a significant number of police officers. That's an entire patrol shift.
That's Sergeant Jeff Dion with the Grand Rapids Police Department. He says concert nights will undoubtedly place a strain on the department, even more so when an Acrisure Amphitheater concert overlaps with events at the Amway Soccer Stadium or the Van Andel Arena. In those instances, 32 officers could be required to manage pedestrian and traffic flow.
That's going to be a really difficult task for us to do that 50 times in 6 months, so a couple times a week.
The city's Office of Emergency Management is overseeing those efforts. It's planning severe weather protocols and discussing access routes for first responders in case of medical emergencies. Sergeant Dion says the police department will initially overstaff events.
But as the summer goes along, we'll realize we don't need two officers there, we need one, and we'll be able to shrink it down. How much? I don't know.
The Rapids Downtown Area Shuttle is considering a shorter public transportation loop through downtown to alleviate congestion around the venue. I'm David Limbaugh.
Residents of Grand Rapids' First Ward are invited to apply for an open city commissioner seat. Former First Ward Commissioner Drew Robbins resigned from the position to run for an open state house seat. The person selected will represent the First Ward through 2026, serving out the remainder of the four-year term. That person may choose to run in the August primary for the next full term. Voters will elect a commissioner in November. Applicants must have lived in Grand Rapids for at least 6 months and be registered to vote in the First Ward. Applications are open through March 24th and are available at the City Clerk's Office or on the City website. Interviews will be held mid-April, and the top three finalists will be interviewed during the City Commission meeting the week of April 20th, which includes time for public input. Commissioners may vote at that meeting or continue discussions. The position pays just over $35,000 a year. Advocates working to save Muskegon's iconic South Breakwater Lighthouse are asking the public for donations to finish the restoration project already underway. WGVU's Dee Morrison reports.
Breakwater Light is one of a kind. There is no other lighthouse of its pattern in the United States.
Built in 1931 on the edge of Lake Michigan, waves and harsh weather have caused significant rust and structural decay.
Today it stands brutally battered after nearly a century of nature's abuse.
Restoring the lighthouse is Kimberly Lang's passion project. The Michigan Lighthouse Conservancy is leading the project. Known as Keeper Kim, Lang provided a progress report to Muskegon City Commissioners. MIM Enterprises began work in September to stabilize and preserve the structure for future generations.
As a welcoming sign to the coming thousands of commercial ships, cruise ships, pleasure ships, and the general public who simply comes and enjoys it from the beach itself.
The total restoration price tag is $1.6 million. The project received an $800,000 state grant. Local supporters are asking the public for donations to complete it this fall. Resident and business owner Don Callis put it this way.
Think of how weird, how odd it would look out there without having that lighthouse, and you'll have terrible pictures. I mean, every photo of Muskegon has that beautiful lighthouse.
I'm Dee Morrison.
And GE Aerospace is investing $1 billion into its U.S. manufacturing facilities. More than $60 million will finance the expansion of two of its West Michigan facilities. GE Aerospace Muskegon campus, which produces components used in regional and wide-body aircraft engines, as well as military fighter jet, helicopter, and maritime engines, is receiving $50 million from company headquarters. In Grand Rapids, it's investing $10 million toward new and upgraded test stations, equipment to expand capacity, along with facility upgrades. The site near Gerald R. Ford International Airport produces avionics used for mission systems navigation and guidance for commercial and military aircraft. Over the past 3 years, GE Aerospace has announced plans to invest nearly $150 million in its Michigan locations. The company is expanding its U.S. workforce this year, hiring an additional 5,000 employees. No word yet on how many of those will be in Michigan. Coming up, a powerful women Let's Talk conversation. Historian Joellen Clary, WGVU's Shelley Irwin. In state news, state officials say they're looking for answers as to whether more could have been done to track and prepare for storms and tornadoes last week that caused at least 4 deaths. We have more from Rick Pluta.
State Senator Sean McCann represents the Kalamazoo area where a tornado struck 2 years ago. The Democratic lawmaker chairs the Senate Energy and Environment Committee, and he says an inquiry is in order into why the National Weather Service did not issue tornado watches in some areas that were struck last week.
Prevention is a lot less expensive than repair, and loss of lives cannot be undone.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer has asked for federal hearings. A spokesperson says the National Weather Service was fully staffed and local offices did issue specific warnings for affected communities. She says the service is, quote, heartbroken over the loss of life in the tornadoes. I'm Rick Pluta.
There's bipartisan support behind Michigan bills to expand the state's missing person alerts beyond kidnapped children, but they're still having trouble passing. Colin Jackson has more.
One set of bills would require sending Amber Alerts for missing special needs children and young adults, as well as in kidnapping cases. Another would require sending alerts for missing older and vulnerable adults. Democratic Senator Mallory McMorrow sponsors the Silver Alert Bill. She says the legislation would put more coordinated resources toward finding missing people.
It can override your focus settings. It can override your do not disturb. It goes onto billboards. It's an automatic system that sends an alert out to every resident in the community.
McMorrow blames politics for the bill's not passing. Her bill is awaiting a hearing in the Republican-controlled House. Republican-sponsored bills are in a similar place in the Democratic-controlled Senate. I'm Colin Jackson. In Detroit.
And many child care workers in Michigan will see a $200 to $300 monthly wage increase thanks to an expanding pilot program. Annette Stobosinski is the executive director at Child Care Network. Her group administers some of the funds for local child care providers. She says the goal of the program is to help underserved communities and give educators more financial support.
We're already hearing stories from educators who are saying, wow, for the first time in a while, I'm able to pay all of my bills this month. And the huge impact it's having on educators who were, you know, considering leaving the field for other higher paying jobs, but didn't want to because they love the work that they're doing.
$16 million in state funds is going to the program. It runs through September 2027. And that is State and West Michigan News here on Focus West Michigan from WGVU. I'm Rick Bierling. In an edited version of this episode of Powerful Women Let's Talk, Shelley Irwin is joined by Jo Ellen Clary, Grand Rapids women's historian, to learn the story of American suffragist Emily Burton Ketchum, who was instrumental in getting women the vote.
This is Powerful Women Let's Talk, conversations with women making an impact in West Michigan.
This season on Powerful Women for Women's History Month, we're looking at women who made history in West Michigan and women, of course, who are making history right now. So today we look at a woman who's made history talking to, well, Jo Ellen Clary. Clary, you have certainly of your own history, you past president of the Greater Grand Rapids Women's History Council, also a Grand Rapids women's historian, here to speak about Emily Burton Ketchum. I'm glad you're here, Jo Ellen.
Thank you, Shelley. It's an honor as always.
Yes. Why have you chosen Emily Burton Ketchum?
You know, for one thing, Emily Burton Ketchum has a place in my heart. I came to Grand Rapids around 1990 and joined the Women's History Council, which was in its childhood then. And I came in because I had known of a woman named Constance Rourke from my professional life. So I got more information about her in Grand Rapids. But in the 1990s, the first woman I was really in hot pursuit of was Emily Burton Ketchum. And she continues in my life as I have learned more and more and more about the history of women's history, the women's accomplishments over the last 190 years. In 2 years, she will have been 190. Her effect keeps spiraling out. The energy, the great force that she used during the 19th century put Grand Rapids on the map in terms of suffrage and other women's movements, and she just found a big place in my heart.
Hmm.
you're sharing the teases. Tell us a little bit about her history local to Grand Rapids.
I mentioned how old she would be. Emily Burton Ketchum is related to the Burton family for Burton Avenue, Burton Park, etc. She was one of the first European American children born here in 1838. Her older brother has sometimes been claimed as the first. So she was here from the start. Emily Burton Ketchum grew up here, went to local schools, St. Mark's Academy and something else, and she ended up going back to New York, Western New York, around Rochester, which is where I think the family came from. And when she was there, she, during the Civil War, she undoubtedly became acquainted with the huge women's movement was there. That's where Susan B. Anthony was spending the Civil War, etc. And then she married a man, Smith G. Ketchum, and moved back to Grand Rapids in 1867, bringing all of those connections with her. So she was from Grand Rapids initially, and then she really became a community builder and women's advocate on the local and state and national stages eventually.
Do we say that she, in her role, would be dubbed as a first wave feminism, her role in this 19th century?
Absolutely, on the cutting edge. First wave feminism really grew out of the abolitionist movement. When early abolitionists like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who might be a familiar name, realized that they weren't welcome at abolitionist meetings, especially in London. There was a worldwide forum called, and they realized they had problems of their own. She was part of a very famous Tea Party in 1848, which is sometimes dubbed the beginning of American feminism. And this small group of women discussing their problems as women called for a first meeting on women's rights in Seneca Falls, New York, in 1848. And what's considered first wave feminism kept growing out of that. Within 12 years, Emily Burton Ketchum was in New York. And so you can see how close she was.
Yes.
And the first wave feminists really lasted through what's called the Progressive Era. Sometimes considered, you know, it was pretty much over around World War I, but by 1920, we'll talk more about what happened during all that time. But in the 1920s, there was a huge backlash after national suffrage was unable all women to vote in 1920, and then think of the 20th century. Just, I can give you a quick nutshell summary. Women during the late 19th century were getting educations. In the 1890s in Grand Rapids, there were more women physicians than in the 1950s in Grand Rapids.
Well, that's a note to take.
Which is one reason
second
wave feminism got feet under itself by the 1970s and really took off again. And so, much of that work had been forgotten.
And so the 1890s were a significant decade for Ketchum and Grand Rapids women?
Oh, yes. I might have told you before that I started looking for her before I even knew her name. When I was first involved in the Women's History Council, I heard a rumor that at some point, the national women's suffrage movement met in Grand Rapids. No dates were given. There seemed not to be easy information. There was no Google. There was precious little attention having been paid to Grand Rapids women. In fact, nationally, women's history really only started being done in the 1970s. So I kept pursuing this. There were historical newspapers online, not quite yet. There were databases in some libraries. In any case, at some point, I learned her name and I found the date. So I got out pieces of information about this woman named Emily Burton Ketchum. I learned a whole lot more than about the national meeting here in 1899. The entire nation's movement came to Grand Rapids, the only time in Michigan. Their names were in the papers. That's when I really started microfilming newspaper research and discovered how huge this was.
Was this a national convention?
Absolutely. They had annual conventions. Wow. And they moved to places where they thought they might have a national effect. It was all Emily Burton Ketchum. By 1899, she had not only state connections. During the 1990s, well, maybe the late 80s, she was the president of the State Suffrage Association four times. There were at least that many meetings, state meetings, in Grand Rapids over those years. And by the end of the decade, she was sitting on the National Council. We have a wonderful picture of her sitting with Susan B. Anthony and all of the national leaders as the national leading group. So she had great range, if you want to call that power, but she had vision and executive ability. She was effective in what she did. And in 1890, the National Women's Congress met in Grand Rapids, another national meeting. So women were having to get together. They had to travel to communicate with each other, and they wrote letters all the time. And at age 69, Emily Burton Ketchum died at her desk writing letters.
Wow.
During the 1890s, then, Grand Rapids women were really coming on board.
What's the best resource for more information on Emily Burton Ketchum and more?
Well, I've mentioned the archive in the Greater Grand Rapids, or the public library, and you can search her, put her name in a search tool and find her there and go in and visit physical objects. The Greater Grand Rapids Women's History Council's website is ggrwhc.org. Click on the suffrage link and bring up a lot of history that involves Ketchum and the women working with her. Click on the Women Who Ran link for a history of women's electoral history. That's another project that we worked on. We documented every single woman who ran, at least in the city of Grand Rapids, between that first win for school board in 1887 and Eva McCall Hamilton's win in the state Senate in 1920. She could run in 1920. Because women in Michigan were enfranchised in 1918. Otherwise, the enfranchisement nationally in August would have been too late for them to be in primaries. But every time a woman could run for something, she did. So they're great models for us. We just don't know a tenth of it.
Thank you very much for this conversation about Emily Burton Ketchum. You, Jewellen Clary, thank you.
Thanks, Shelley.
The full version of this podcast episode of Powerful Women Let's Talk is available online with previous episodes at wgvunews.org, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts. And that is Focus West Michigan for today, Tuesday, March 10th, 2026. I'm Rick Bierling. Patrick Center is WGVU's News and Public Affairs Director. We'll see you on Wednesday.